My name is Carla Soria, and as president of the Asian Pacific American Law Students Association, it is my pleasure to welcome you all to our first annual 1L lecture. Together with the Black Law Students Association, we have planned this evening to focus on the topic of diversity in legal education and in the legal profession. I have the honor of introducing our two speakers, Professor Tomiko Brown-Nagin and Mr. C. Edward Polk. And starting off with Professor Brown-Nagin, Professor Tomiko Brown-Nagin received her BA summa cum laude from Furman University. She holds a doctorate in history from Duke University and earned her law degree from Yale, where she was an editor of the Yale Law Journal. Professor Brown-Nagin teaches courses on American social and legal history, constitutional law, education law and policy, and public interest law. She has written widely on civil rights history and law and published in both law and history journals. She's currently working on a book, Courage to Dissent, about lawyers, courts, and community-based activism during the civil rights era. Professor Brown-Nagin was the Charles Warren Visiting Professor of American Legal History at Harvard Law School in fall 2008. Prior to entering teaching, she clerked for the Honorable Robert L. Carter of the U.S. District Court, Southern District of New York, and the Honorable Jane Roth of the United States Court of Appeals, Third Circuit. She also worked as a litigation associate at Paul Weiss in New York. Before entering private practice, Professor Brown-Nagin held the Charles Hamilton Houston Fellowship at Harvard Law School and Samuel I. Gottlieb Fellowship at Legal History at New York University School of Law. So with that, please welcome Professor Brown-Nagin.
Good evening. Thank you so much for that introduction. I am so honored to be here at this event co-sponsored by BALSA, APULSA, and Foley and Gardner. It is certainly my pleasure. I view teaching and mentoring all students from all walks of life as an important part of my duties as a law professor. And it's especially important to me to support women, students of color, and outsider communities, however defined. So as I said, I'm honored to be here. Now, you asked me to talk to you about the topic of diversity. Who cares? Well, judging from our public discourse, there's an easy answer to that question. Most everybody today cares about diversity. References to diversity saturate public discourse. Everybody's doing it, diversity. All Fortune 500 companies express a commitment to employing a diverse workforce. Every law firm, even NASCAR, has a diversity program called Drive for Diversity. It's a matter of social convention today to proclaim one's commitment to inclusion. Public figures who violate the norm by hurling a racial slur or having a macaca moment can quickly become persona non grata, at least for a time. So we police and enforce a rhetorical commitment to diversity. Recently, the United States Supreme Court affirmed educational institutions' commitment to diversity. In 2003's Grutter versus Bollinger, a majority of the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of race-sensitive admissions in higher education. Justice O'Connor, who wrote for the majority, explained that diversity confers compelling benefits. It promotes cross-racial understanding, breaks down stereotypes, promotes better learning outcomes, and prepares students for a diverse workforce and society. She cited amicus briefs filed by an impressive array of institutions, the military, universities, social scientists, bipartisan members of Congress, and CEOs of major business concerns. And she said, in order to cultivate a set of leaders with legitimacy in the eyes of the citizenry, it is necessary that the path to leadership be visibly opened to talented and qualified individuals of every race and ethnicity. Of course, our national embrace and celebration of diversity reached a fever pitch recently when the country entered the age of President Obama. As well, we should have. We should commemorate our arrival at this more perfect union. So there, resolved. Everyone, most everyone, cares about diversity. In fact, you could say that diversity is chic. Now, unfortunately, many conversations about diversity end right there, with pledges of allegiance to diversity. In truth, I would suggest that that should only be the beginning of the matter. I want to move this evening beyond platitudes, beyond the question of whether diversity is beneficial to our society. I consider that question settled. It is. And to thornier questions about the challenges posed by our commitment to diversity, to the question of how we, as subjects and objects of the commitment to diversity, experience the substance of diversity in everyday life. Now, one point of entry for a deeper conversation about diversity is to engage the word of choice that some have taken to using to describe this poignant moment in our history. Some have labeled it post-racial, as I'm sure you've heard. That would not be my word of choice. For if we've witnessed a genuine racial transformation at the electoral level, we also are in a racially volatile period. Many embrace change, but others evidently are profoundly disturbed by it. Witness the coarsening of our political discourse signified by increasing use of racially inflammatory rhetoric, symbols, and even threats. Given the uncertainties that abound in society today, it seems to me that it would be ill-advised to assume a trajectory of progress in the workplace, in schools, and in society at large. In fact, this country's history of race does not support the notion that progress is inevitable. It suggests just the opposite. Following periods of racial advance, there have often been periods of racial retrenchment. Consider the period of retrenchment in the South following the abolition of slavery, which gave us segregation under law. Think of the backlash against the minority poor following passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act during the mid-1960s. Bear in mind the dismantling of precedents designed to desegregate schools almost as quickly as the Supreme Court started to intervene in earnest to integrate schools around 1968. Historically, racial change has not been linear. And one can observe similar dynamics of progress and regress in the history of women and in other minorities, all of the groups that we think of when we call to mind the concept of diversity. Women's reproductive rights advances have been fiercely contested in the courts. Women have entered the professional workplace but faced glass ceilings and other forms of discrimination. For gays and lesbians, the timeline of progress and the indicia of change are even harder to chart. We can see fits and starts of progress in the struggle for gay marriage, for instance, where a legislative win here is followed by a judicial reversal there. So progress is not steady. It is not necessarily a forward march. Now, let's move back to the present, bearing in mind the lessons of the past about the uncertain path that we have traveled toward a more inclusive society. In light of all of the effort required historically to implement diversity, I want to challenge you here tonight to activate your commitment to diversity, to give substance to diversity, to make inclusion real and concrete, not simply rhetorical, in the classroom and in the workplace. For it's you, young law students and lawyers, who have the power to decide what diversity is and what it becomes in this moment of possibility as well as transition. Now, a first step in making real the opportunity that's presented by a rhetorical commitment to diversity is realizing how privileged you are. You could appreciate your special role in the move toward more diverse classrooms and workplaces by considering statistics on the demographic makeup of the legal profession and selective law schools. According to the ABA's most recent report, about 6% of partners at law firms are from three racial minority groups, blacks, Hispanics, and Asians. That is to say, 94% are white. Of minority associates in large law firms, the majority are Asian. Asians are 10% of associates nationally, blacks less than 5%, Hispanics about 3.5%. Numbers vary by region, of course. Blacks are clustered in certain markets, as are Latinos and Asians, meaning that in many markets, the numbers of minority associates are tiny. What about law schools? Well, during the decade from 1997 to 2007, blacks, now a little less than 13% of the population, accounted for about 3,000 of the nation's 46,000 law school matriculates, or an average of 7%. Hispanics, now about 15% of the population, for about 4% of students, and Asians, now roughly 5% of the population, about 8% of matriculates. Black and Hispanic law students are underrepresented in the law school population very clearly. These statistics only provide a snapshot. They do not tell the whole story about law school admissions. For instance, while Asians as a group are overrepresented among law students, certain subgroups of Asians are vastly underrepresented. So the snapshot is not perfect, but it provides one clear picture. Whites are overwhelmingly dominant in law schools and the legal profession, and the numbers of racial minorities are small. All of which is to say, you are members of a privileged class. You have access to educational and employment opportunities that many before you could not have dreamed of, and many members of your community still cannot dream of today. And I want to remind you that prior generations of lawyers, most prominently Justice Thurgood Marshall, worked at risk of life and limb to open up these doors of opportunity to you. Justice Marshall and his team of lawyers at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund won cases including Sweat versus Painter, the case challenging race-based exclusion at the University of Texas Law School, and of course Brown versus Board of Education, the case in which state-sanctioned segregation in education was found unconstitutional. These precedents set in motion a series of legal and political developments that have enabled you the opportunity to be considered for admission to the University of Virginia Law School. You and I stand on the shoulders of giants, and because of them, you have within your grasp the reins of leadership in school and community at this moment of possibility and contest over diversity. There are two main contexts where you'll find yourself called upon to decide what meaning to give to diversity. In particular, whether to perform diversity actively or passively in light of the controversies that diversity can sometimes generate. First, there's the classroom. Racial minorities are welcomed into law school classrooms through targeted recruitment efforts, as well as, in some individual cases, affirmative action admissions policies. As I earlier described, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld carefully crafted race-sensitive admissions at the University of Michigan against a constitutional challenge in 2003. Nevertheless, the question of whether affirmative action admits or qualified persists. Consider, for instance, a 2004 study published the year after the Supreme Court upheld university affirmative action, arguing against the concept on grounds that these admits are mismatched at the educational institutions to which they matriculate. The upshot, according to this study, is lower average grades and low bar passage rates. The author's study singled out black students and concluded that they would be better off at lower ranked law schools. Now, a frenzy of interest in this study ensued, notwithstanding the fact there was nothing new in the claims, and the empirical research behind it was quickly and persuasively challenged. I suspect you've heard about this study, or if not, about the general idea that affirmative action harms educational institutions and harms racial minorities themselves. I want to draw your attention to different research, cutting-edge research about minorities in higher education, about which you probably have not heard. This research focuses on underperformance by high-ability students at selective institutions, minorities and women who have the same entering credentials as whites and males. Again, the same entering credentials. A subset of collegians that it seems seldom captures the interest in most discussions of outsider access to elite educational institutions because most are too busy viewing minorities in particular as deficient or underqualified. Now, what does this literature tell us? That highly intelligent minorities in overwhelmingly white selective institutions are subject to underperform due to what's called stereotype threat. These students feel tremendous pressure to represent their race or gender, to disprove the old canard that they are underqualified. They fear making any mistake, lest it prove that they don't belong. They suffer under the weight of stereotypes. They sometimes feel ignored or slighted in class by faculty or students who presume themselves to be superior. They don't know whom to trust in these environments. These students are in the spotlight, bearing the burdens of integration in a society in which race can still profoundly shape identity. This pressure can breed alienation and depressed performance. Now, the initial research on stereotype threat was completed in undergraduate institutions. However, other studies have found a similar phenomenon of underperformance by minorities and women in law schools as well, selective law schools like Penn, Harvard, and Yale. Underperformance, whether measured by grades, law review membership, clerkships, or the most prestigious positions after graduation. Now, why am I telling you about this literature? Well, because I think it powerfully reframes the discussion of diversity in higher education. Unlike the mismatch theory, it presumes that any performance gap between outsiders and insiders in higher education doesn't necessarily result from deficits in women and minority students themselves. Rather, it can stem from their educational and social environments. That is, provided that students have certain threshold levels of ability, the psychological literature suggests that achievement is not determined by the kinds of differences in LSAT or SAT scores that some seize upon to brand students as unqualified for admission to this institution or that one. In other words, one has to be smart enough, and admissions officers have only to admit those who are smart enough to succeed, but one doesn't have to be a superstar, although you certainly might. But there's a caveat this literature suggests. Analytical intelligence is necessary, but not enough to excel in the law. One also needs access to social networks, to insider information, and a host of characteristics such as ambition, persistence, resilience, and interpersonal and emotional intelligence to advance in the law. And all students, again, all students, but particularly minority students, women, and other outsiders, often need support in developing these qualities and accessing this information and these networks. They need help. that is, in developing the social capital needed to flourish intellectually. Now, this literature, I believe, asks those of us who profess a commitment to diversity to actively engage the question of how diverse communities can be better integrated into majority-dominant institutions. I hope that faculty and administrators in educational institutions will consider that question. Meanwhile, individuals can help themselves. I want to encourage you to facilitate your own success and combat the risk of underperformance through your commitment to being active and engaged members of the law school classroom and the law school community. The question then becomes, what do I mean by active and engaged members? Well, I want to give you some tips. First, be aggressive thinkers. Don't sit back and await further instructions from anyone. Ask questions, puzzle over things, visit faculty during office hours. Passivity is not an advantage in law school, nor in life. Second, find your voice and actively participate in class discussions. And I want to belabor this point a bit about voice. When I say find your voice, I mean your authentic voice, whatever that may be. And I say that knowing that speaking can be burdensome when one feels that one is forever representing one's sex or one's race or gender. Just recently, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a self-proclaimed beneficiary of workplace affirmative action, spoke eloquently about being an object of curiosity as one of a few women in law school and even on the Supreme Court, a feeling, as she put it, as if every eye is on you. That's a tremendous amount of pressure. Hence, I want to suggest to you that you not think in those terms. You're an individual who happens also to be a minority or a woman, and if others cannot see that, then that's frankly their problem and not yours. Third, I want to impress upon you the need to work hard. Don't let anyone out-hustle you. Barack Obama did not make president of the Harvard Law Review simply because he was intellectually gifted. He did so because of his intellect and because he worked harder and more smartly than others. Justice Sotomayor did not have her note published in the Yale Law Journal simply because of her intellect. She rewrote and she revised. She developed an outstanding work ethic as she climbed to the pinnacle of the legal profession. So must you if you want to succeed. Fourth, I want to encourage you to develop social networks. You cannot go it alone. Find spaces where you can share your experiences without fear of judgment. And I mean experiences derived from being the voice of and the representatives of diversity. There is nothing peculiar about this need, about seeking social and intellectual spaces of one's own, safe spaces where you can relax, where you can commiserate, celebrate, enjoy your life. Each of these practices will prepare you for your careers with employers in a variety of institutions, many of which will have limited experiences with diverse workforces, you must understand, although they have a great deal of interest in recruiting diverse candidates. I mentioned literature on the experience of minorities and women in undergraduate institutions and law schools. There also has been important work on the experiences of minority and women lawyers in law firms, of which you should be aware. One important piece asks the question, why are there so few black lawyers in corporate law firms? Now, rather than assuming that the answer was the pool problem, or the putative lack of qualified minority applicants. This study's authors looked at internal firm dynamics for answers to this question. They asked, how might the structure and practices of law firms themselves explain the low numbers of minorities in these firms? What these scholars found is that the economics of the workplace, as well as interpersonal and social dynamics, often work to disadvantage minority associates in the recruitment and promotion processes. Firms, of course, generally recruit associates based on grades and other traditional indicia of achievement. Interviews mainly assess personality and fit, which are subjective assessments of social skills. I've already mentioned why grades may not provide an accurate picture of a law firm's, of a law student's promise. Most minorities are screened out at the recruitment stage. Let's assume, however, that you land a job in one of these firms. Because good lawyers are made, not born, the question then becomes which associates are trained and cultivated in these firms? Who receives the mentoring necessary to move up the ladder in the firm environment? Well, it turns out that law firm senior associates and partners tend to train and mentor few young lawyers. Those who are trained and mentored are those who seem the least risky investments, those who need the least supervision, and those with whom these individuals have personal comfort levels, people with whom they can identify, in short, people who tend to be like themselves. And sadly, for all of these reasons, race and gender are barriers that limit minorities' access to the training and mentoring they need to succeed. Women of color face a double bind. Note that this disadvantage is not necessarily the result of conscious bias. Rather, it's the product of complex and subtle social and psychological phenomena among even the best-intentioned people, combined with structural features of the firm that apply to all employees, but which can have a disproportionate adverse impact on minorities and women. And yet, like the advantages that sometimes are posed by being minorities and women in educational institutions, there are steps that individuals can take to mitigate these disadvantages. First, I want to impress upon you the need to choose wisely. Research employers' records on diversity. Talk to diverse associates who have worked at these firms. Do your best to find out how open the environment is to advancement. All firms are not the same. That's a myth. Second, be aggressive thinkers and socially assertive once you enter these firms. Ask for work in specific areas of interest. Ask questions about your assignments. Figure out what you don't know and find answers to those questions. Use interpersonal and emotional intelligence in interactions with partners and with senior associates. Third, develop supportive social networks, the same kind that I've encouraged you to develop as law students. And finally, consider that your reputation is everything. Produce excellent work product. And if you've been an active learner, an engaged student, you will be better positioned to do precisely that. Of course, private law firms are not the only legal employers that you might consider. In fact, the relatively low numbers of women and minorities in these law firms may reflect, in part, intelligent opting out of these firms to pursue more satisfying careers. The large law firm job search may be the easiest path, but it may not be the best path for you. Of course, many graduates in this economy are turning to pro bono work in nonprofit organizations as a way of filling time that they suddenly have on their hands. But I urge you to consider these jobs first as a matter of your first choice. Lawyers who work in the public sphere for nonprofits and government consistently report greater levels of career satisfaction and greater quality of life. In other words, they're happier, which is a benefit. At the same time, these lawyers, like the legal giants on whose shoulders we all stand, the Thurgood Marshalls of the legal profession, are helping our society address the vast needs of indigent and socially marginalized people, those truly at the bottom of society. Now, I want to acknowledge that I haven't stood here and repeated platitudes about diversity. That, it seems to me, is a passive way of addressing the issue. It costs nothing to mouth that rhetoric, and it provides little guidance about how to achieve substantive progress in the classroom and at work. I've tried to present you with a realistic assessment of the challenges that are posed by diversity in order to equip you with the knowledge that can help you advance. I have done so, I must say, because I myself have experienced both the promise and the peril of diversity. Most of the tips that I'm giving to you are born of my own experience. I can recall very well entering the hallowed halls of Yale Law School in 1993 as the first person in my family to graduate from college and having to learn how to negotiate the legal world without the access to the social networks, the resources, and other matters that I've told you are crucial to success. I worked hard and I worked smartly. I remember how grueling journal tryouts were, but I also remember the sweetness of success. I've experienced the sheer exhaustion that can accompany representing one's race and sex. I've lost my voice from time to time, here and there, when faced with barriers to entry, social, economic, and interpersonal, rather than the kinds of legal barriers that Thurgood Marshall toppled. I've searched and searched for mentors, but I've pushed through, I've made my way with the help of family, friends, inside and outside of school and the workplace, and yes, even a few mentors at crucial points along the way. So I have great confidence that you can do these things too. And I'll end by emphasizing a point with which I began. You've arrived. You're part of a very privileged class. You've earned access to UVA. Now I would challenge you to make it yours. The benefits of diversity, cross-racial understanding, better learning outcomes, breaking down stereotypes, a more prepared workforce, all of these things that the Supreme Court majority recently endorsed will not occur through passivity. Take up some space at UVA. Develop a sense of entitlement to learn and to share equally in all that this institution has to offer. It's your law school. The community is what you make of it and what you demand of it. You're laying the groundwork for what I hope will be satisfying and trailblazing careers in the law, launched from Mr. Jefferson's University, now yours and mine. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor, for those remarks. And it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Mr. C. Edward Polk, Jr., with Foley & Lardner, where he is a member of the firm's IP litigation practice. Mr. Polk's practice focuses on litigation of complex patent cases in a variety of technologies. He also focuses on prosecuting and defending actions against the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in reexaminations, appeals before the Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences, appeals before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and defense of disciplinary proceedings brought by the Office of Enrollment and Discipline. Prior to joining Foley, Mr. Polk worked as an associate solicitor for the United States Patent and Trademark Office, where he argued cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal and Fourth Circuits and the Eastern District of Virginia. Mr. Polk was also responsible for drafting and reviewing USPTO rules, regulations, and legislation, and served as a prosecuting attorney for the Office of Enrollment and Discipline in disciplinary cases involving members of the patent bar. He received his JD with honors from the George Washington University Law School and earned his undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Maryland, College Park. Mr. Polk is co-chair of Foley's African American Affinity Group and chairs its tutoring program for Wilkinson Elementary School. Mr. Polk is also the current chair of the Diversity Committee for the American Intellectual Property Law Association, former chair of the Intellectual Property Law Section for the National Bar Association, and a member of the American Bar Association. He is also a member of the board of directors for the Institute for Responsible Citizenship. So, Mr. Polk.
And I also say it's an absolute pleasure and honor to be here today. Just want to talk a little bit about kind of the diversity in the law profession itself. Second thing, kind of give you a little bit of my own background, my experience of being a minority attorney, and I've only worked in large law firms, so that's kind of the perspective that I have. Here in law school, kind of what to expect as a law student, again, looking at the different options that you can have being a law student, and finally, talk a little bit about keeping the practice of law in perspective. This is my kind of advice I always give when I do these types of talks. But a little bit about, again, my background. I do a lot of our firm's recruiting, so I see a lot of the issues that you spoke about. And again, also I'm chair of African American Affinity Group, which is kind of our mentorship arm that kind of keeps an eye on folks that are within our firm itself. Diversity in law firms. I've only been practicing probably about 11 or 12 years now. And I remember when I first started, and that wasn't that long ago, diversity was a statement in a brochure that said that we don't discriminate and everyone, race, creed, and color is welcome to apply. That's all diversity really meant when I first started practicing again, and that wasn't that long ago. As times have evolved, and I think things certainly have gotten much better than when I first started practicing law, and I would love to tell you that it got better because law firms finally realized that it was the right thing to do, but I'd be lying to you if I said that. What really started the trend is when you had corporations, our clients, who started saying, looking at the bills and looking who was working on their matters and started to realize that there are no diversity whatsoever that are working on our matters. And if you want to continue working for us, you're going to have diverse individuals working on our matters. You had what's called the call to action. If I'm not mistaken, I believe Sarah Lee was the one who started that. And there are a lot of other situations that were brought up like that where the companies really said, we want diverse individuals working on our matters. And that was really kind of started the process of law firms realizing that we've got to diversify our ranks. And also one of the things I think really kind of helped spur the diversity movement within the law firm was you started having more and more people of diverse backgrounds, color, ethnic diversity, gender diversity. We're in a position of making hiring decisions. And that was, when you couple the corporations, and then you also have individuals of diversity who are making those hiring decisions, that is one of the forces that really, really started pushing diversity in law firms. So I say this to say that right now I think you are in a good situation there. Is it a great situation? No, but it's far better than I think it was when I started practicing law. Law firms, and I think companies in general, are really looking for high-achieving students, diverse students from very good law schools. And I go through probably several hundred resumes each year. And I know one of the things I look for myself is I try to look for first, where are diverse candidates? And those are one of the things, obviously, looking at me, those are one of the things that I look for when I first looked at through resumes when I see them. So I want to make sure that we are, as a firm, and I think a lot of firms overall are doing this as well, is trying to make sure that they are able to meet the diversity needs of their clients. And I'll give you one example where I think it, just a small example when I started working at our firm, where you realize that having a different perspective really does matter and can make a difference, even a small difference. We represent a lot of Japanese clients, and we were involved in litigation, and there was we were really butting heads with opposing counsel. And we were sending an email to our clients, Japanese clients, and they were saying that, in the email, and they send it around, usually kind of, if there's an email, they circulate it, kind of give your thoughts, just, you're going to send it to the client. And one of the things it said in there is, you know, the other side's proposing this nuclear bomb option. And I said, well, maybe that's not something that American law firm wants to send to a Japanese client there. I said, just think about that. And just a different perspective. Was there anything malicious meant by it? Absolutely not. It was just describing, we thought someone was just really trying to do a scorched earth situation. And the partner, I was a senior associate at that time, and he called me, sent an email, said, thank you, I'd never thought about that. And it's just a different perspective that you bring to the table. It's not, and again, I may think very different from you, and from everyone else, but it's having that different perspective that I think that clients tend to realize does make a difference and does help you as you're doing performing legal work. My own experience, kind of looking back as I started from a law school and now with my fellow partner that we made this year at the law firm, the journey that I've gone through, and one of the things you said that is very true, you got to, you know, the fit, there's such thing as a fit within an organization, be it a law firm, be it a corporation, or wherever it may be. There is such thing as that, and two law firms are not the same. They're very different, and just as two corporations are very different. I think I try to hold a record for the number of law firms that I've been at there. But I think one summer I actually did three law firms, and I think that's a record. I try to hold that record dear to my heart there. But I've seen a lot of different places there, and I've seen where when you fit. I started off as a full-time day student, and my wife got pregnant. I said, somebody needs to go get a job, so I started working as an evening student. I started working full-time and going to school as an evening student. And very good situation. I was very well liked within the firm. Had a lot of good mentors. That's something I'll touch on a little bit later of how important mentorship is. I can't stress enough how important that is no matter what environment that you happen to be in. And that was a great fit. By the time I started graduating, another law firm threw a ton of money at me, said, come on over, Ed. We love you, and come over here, and we want you to come work for us. And when I left, I realized that, well, you know, this is not all law firms are the same. And that was the first point in my career when I started to realize that, you know, it's more in any environment, and especially in a large law firm, there's more to it than just being smart. There's more to it than just being able to do good work. That's the minimum requirement, I think, to succeed in any environment. But there is a level of mentorship, people looking out for you, giving you those right assignments, putting you in the right situation to where you can really shine and really achieve very good success. I had, after my second law firm, I was very frustrated with the practice of law. I had gotten in a situation where I didn't have a lot of mentors. I didn't think I had a lot of people really helping me and looking out for my career. And when I left, and I'll keep law firms nameless there, but when I left, I wonder if anyone even knows that I left it. They may wonder if I'm still sitting in my office or something. But, you know, and I really felt when I left they could have actually cared less that I actually did leave, or probably had a good smile that I did. But I really got frustrated with the practice of law. And I said, I've had enough. You know, when I left law school, and a lot of people today that I interview and talk with younger students, you know, my generation, we're more kind of, you know, being a partner in a large law firm was something that, you know, a lot of people aspired to. I found today, as I do a lot of recruiting, that's not necessarily this generation what you're looking for. But for me, that was what I had really, when I left law school, that was one of my goals. And I'd gotten to the point where I was so frustrated, had no mentors, no one's looking out for me. And I've always said I've been very blessed in my career that, you know, when I've had things that I thought were downers, have turned out to be very good. And I just went out to lunch one day with a friend of mine, and he said, well, actually a friend of mine from Arnold Porter, we went out to lunch, and he was like, you know, how are you doing over where you happen to be? And I said, well, you know, just not really doing much there, not having a, you know, I came here to get certain experience. I'm not getting it. And he said, well, a friend of mine, he's the solicitor of the Patent and Trademark Office. He said, and I think they might be looking for someone. I'm like, well, what do they do? And he kind of told me, well, they get in the courtroom, they argue, and I'm like, wow, I want to be litigated at. Kind of sounds like something I'd like to do. I said, I might be interested. About 2 o'clock that next day, I got a call from him, and about 3 months later, I was working there. And I say that to say, you know, you got to be flexible and always keep your options open. And I got there, and that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me in my career. Because, one, it gave me a kind of time out from the law firm environment, and it allowed me to go and hone some of my skills that I wasn't getting in a law firm environment. And that's when I say, I was coming up on about my fourth or fifth year, I wanted to be a litigator, and I'd probably been to 2 depositions. So I could have probably told you how that partnership decision was going to go, a litigator who doesn't know how to litigate. That was not going to go too well. So that's when I said, when I got the opportunity to go to the patent office, got the opportunity to get in the courtroom, get to argue cases. And that's where I think I really got to develop and hone my skills. So I say that a lot of even the younger associates that I work with and that I try to mentor, they say, you know, you got to keep your options open. If you're not getting that experience, you know, that you want, you know, the government is a great option to go and really hone your skills and get certain level of training that sometimes you may not get in a law firm environment. So, and one of the other things that I think, you know, really helped change the course of my career is I got involved with the National Bar Association, which is a large African-American bar association. And there's many different minority bar associations that you can become a part of. And not that there's anything wrong with the majority bar associations, but that was one that I think was a good fit for me. And while I was there, I happened to, became the head of the IP section. And there was an article called, there's MCC Minority Corporate Council, MCCA, puts out a magazine. And they had an article called IP Superstars. And it highlighted a bunch of minority attorneys who were doing very well in the IP profession, which is what I practice in. I invited every one of them to come down and speak at a bar conference in New Orleans. And lo and behold, every one of them accepted. So we had about 8 people, and I had a way more stacked panel than I thought. So that was interesting, but I got to meet a lot of good people who came down. And one of the people that I happened to meet at that conference was a lady named Sharon Barner, who is the head of our IP department, African-American lady. And I stayed in contact with her. And I was at the patent office, and one of the things, another friend of mine was in Chicago, and he would call me every couple of months, like, you know, you ready to come back to private practice? I'm like, no. I'm here at the patent office. I'm having a good time. I'm arguing cases. I got a good life. I'm not ready to come back yet. So he called me that one day where it was kind of the right time. I said, okay, you called me on that right day. I think I'm ready. So my interview was, I said, hey, guys, I'm arguing a case here at the Federal Circuit on such and such a day. Why don't you come look at me? You'll see what you're getting. And they came look. It's the only place I put a resume in was the firm I'm at now. And that was because I knew someone who was there. We had a few stripes on their shoulder who could look out for me. And another friend of mine, we left the patent office about the same time, and he did one of those where he just sent all his resumes out to everyone and just was fine. I said, why don't you find someone? If you want to go back to law firm, why don't you find someone you have a connection with? Someone who you have something in common with, who has a few stripes on the shoulder, is going to look out for you. That's my military training, so I call it stripes on the shoulder, if you forgive me there. But so I said, why don't you try and find somewhere that you know someone? He said, you and I both know in the solicitor's office there's a lot of ex-law firmers who have now gone to the government. And I said, you know how the law firm is, so why don't you, you know, try to find some? Oh, no, I'll be fine. Okay. He lasted about a year. White male. Very talented, lasted about a year. And I say that to say, mentoring is that important, regardless of who you are, white, black, male, female. It's that important. And not just the law firm environment, but no matter where you go, it's that important. So I've been very blessed in my career to be able to find mentors who have really looked out for me. And I tell you again, that it's that important. When it comes to people who leave, who come and go, again, in a large law firm environment, usually it's not because of lack of talent. I mean, certainly there's people every now and then that's not the environment that they should be in, but Usually it's not a lack of talent. A lot of times it's they just didn't get that opportunity. They get disillusioned and they just don't find that person who's cultivating their career. And I say that, and again, when you look for mentors, it's not just someone who looks like you. I've been blessed to have mentors, white males, black, well, I haven't had too many black males because there aren't very many of us in the law firm, but I've had black females in our firm, and it's across the board. And there's an Indian gentleman who I work with quite a bit, a partner in the office, and I remember he and I were going out when I first got to the firm, probably I'd been there maybe a year or two. We were just taking depositions, and he said, Ed, if you ever have any problems, anything, I don't ever want to see you leave this firm before you at least come talk to me and see if there's something we can resolve. And when you get people looking out for you like that, you know, that's what you're looking for. When I say if you want to succeed in whatever your environment you may be in, you want to find those people who are really looking out for you and can help you and help manage your career. And one of the things you had mentioned, you know, if you want to look at their diversity statistics when you do that, one of the things you want to make sure, and again, I think most of you are 1Ls out here, is that correctly? Yeah, so as you start going into the recruiting season and looking for stuff there, you know, one of the things you want to look for is, you know, where can I find a good mentor? You know, that's, and it's across, there are a lot of good firms out here, and there's a lot of, you know, and there, and I've always said, you know, you can have two people in the same firm whose experience are completely different, very different, same law firm, maybe working with the same group of people whose experiences are very different. And that's because this one person is getting a lot more mentoring than the other. When it comes to law school, what to expect here, especially as 1Ls you're here in law school. One of the things, and I think you touched on this as well, minority students tend to, your grades are not as good the first year, but they tend to pick up as you go along. So it's certainly, you know, I've never seen anything wrong with ability. It's understanding and the knowledge to what are they looking for? What are those professors looking for on your law school exams? Go talk with your professors. I'm sure they'll tell you. They'll tell you what they're looking for up front. You know, this is what we expect here. You hear this writing like a lawyer. You know, I did very well in my first year. I was very fortunate, shocked the heck out of me. I'll admit I was certainly an affirmative action brought into law school there. My LSAT was not the greatest. I think my rejection, I think when I sent it to Harvard, and probably here as well, was probably the quickest in the history of rejections there. But I did exceptionally well when I got there. And certainly, if you look at the record, I was not the one you would expect to do that. But when I got to law school, I said, look, this is an investment in me. How much do I believe in myself there? I'm going to work harder than anyone else. I went to one party in 3 years. I had, and that was probably because I was our section chair and I had to go. I said it meant that much to me. I was going to outwork anyone there. And when I called up that first semester and got my grades, I was like, wow. You know, if you guys watch Sanford and Son, it might not be too young to remember that, but I'm Elizabeth, I'm coming to join you. But I was shocked. And I saw what hard work really pays off there. So I say that to say that your grades are that important. And I tell you from a recruiting perspective why they are. If you want to be in a large law firm, your first year grades are all we really get to see when we make that hiring decision. Because the most important summer is your 2L summer. So this summer here, you know, go take a boat trip to France or something there. You know, go work for a law firm if you want. But it's not that critical, your first year. It's that second year that really matters. So when you make that second year hiring decision, all we see are your first year grades. That's it. And as long as you haven't flunked out, if you've done well, your second, if you've done well during the summer, then usually that's what we make our hiring decision on. It's not your second year grades. So what gets you in the door are your first year grades. One of the things, and I'll offer it to anyone here, one of the things we're doing at GW in a couple of weeks is going over there and having an exam taking session with them. Sit down and saying, this is how you want to take exam. This is what you want to do. And, you know, it's something I think you should do because you all have the ability. Don't think otherwise. You do. You're as smart as anyone here. You got here, you're smart enough to be here. Your grades, and again, historically, minority students' grades aren't as good the first year, you know. And again, it's not because of ability. So that's what you want to do is equip yourself. Work hard, equip yourself to make your grades work. The other thing you want to think about here while you're in law school is look around you. These are your, if you want to be in a law firm environment, and again, that's the perspective that I see from, your general counsel, Somebody in here is going to be general counsel one day. These are your people who are going to have hiring decisions years down the road. So when you're in that environment and you're a partner and you're looking to increase your business, these are the folks you're going to be calling. You know, get to know these people here. I remember one of my mentors told me years ago, the worst thing for an attorney is to be unknown. You know, this is a profession where people need to know who you are. They need to know your abilities, and they need to know who you are. You know, don't go in the library and, you know, get stuck in there and never come out again until exam time. You know, get to know the people around you. It's that important. This is the network that you're creating here. Get to know everyone. And understand that all of the lawyers that are out here, this is a small profession. Don't burn bridges. It's something I've learned a long time ago. You do not burn bridges. These are the ones who will eventually be your colleagues in whatever environment it may be in. You know, make those connections now. Cultivate them. That is something that minority students, I think, have a problem with, and minorities in general, have a problem with when it comes to cultivating, understanding how to cultivate your network. I've had a lot of attorneys that have really taken me under their wings and said, this is how you do it, this is how you cultivate, and given me their connections and say, here, this. And one of our partners always tells me, you know, the thing you never want to do is try to toot your own horn. You want others to do it. And that's where your mentoring comes in. That's what your mentor is there for, to toot your horn to others who can work with you. I tell you, there was a white male in our office who gave me my first case to litigate myself. And I remember when he came up and he told me one day, he said, look, Ed, this is the perfect case for you to take. We've already told the client that we're going to lose. So he said, if you lose, it's expected. And you can say you did, you worked hard. But if you win, you're a god. So he said, it's a low-pressure case. I remember the night before I argued the case in D.C. District Court, I was talking to Sharon Barner, who's the head of our IP department. I said, you know, here are the facts of the case. She's like, It's like, okay, we won the case. And we won the case. He sent an email to the whole firm and said, hey, Ed's a mechanical engineer. This is a pharmaceutical case. Look how great he is. If I had said it myself, they would have been like, yeah, he's just tooting his own horn. But to have someone else that others respect say it, that's where mentoring comes in. And again, he looks nothing like me, but he's been a great mentor to me. So don't, you know, you got to keep a wide net when you look for your mentors. And last, I guess, I don't keep everyone whose stomachs maybe start to get a little hungry, so I don't want to stay up here too long, but one of the things I also say is, and this has nothing to do with diversity, it just has to be with the practice of law. Keep the practice of law in perspective. I remember when I interviewed here at Foley, when I was at the patent office, and the gentleman I told you who's in our firm who kept calling me up said, you know, Ed, you ready to come out? He was clerking at the Federal Circuit, and I called him up one day. I said, you know what? Let's go coach a peewee football team. He said, we don't know anything about coaching. I'm like, the parents don't know. Let's get a book. We'll get a book. We'll read about it. We'll figure it out. And that was 7 years ago. And I've coached peewee football for every year since then. And when you guys pray for me tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. We're playing probably our toughest game of the season, so you guys, yeah, we need that. But when I interviewed, I sat down to talk with who's now the head of our litigation department. And I said, look, I mean, nothing disrespectful here. I said, I coach a peewee football team. I understand I'm not Vince Lombardi. You know, I'm not getting paid to coach football. But it's my diversion from the law. It's something I enjoy doing. And I said, you know, if I have to get here at 5 o'clock in the morning to get my work done so I can leave by 2 or 3 to go make it to practice, then, you know, I hope that no one's going to be upset with me. In other words, I hope there's no FaceTime requirement here, because quite honestly, right now, I probably work 1 or 2 days a week from home. But I said, you know, I said, if that's going to be a problem, no disrespect, you know, I'll stay where I'm at the patent office. So I said, you know, and I said it very nicely. He said, no, there's no problem. As long as you're getting your work done, nobody cares. And he's right. That's what I've appreciated. And there's a partner in our L.A. office. I remember we went out to a hearing in Delaware, and we were sitting there just talking before the hearing. And he said, you know what, Ed, don't think that this law firm can't live without you. Don't think you can't go off on your own and take a vacation. You die tomorrow, we're going to roll you out your desk, we're going to clean it out and put somebody else in there. And I say that to say, you know, keep the practice of law in perspective. It's a great profession. I've never looked back. I think it, you know, if I had it do over again, I wouldn't have changed anything. But don't make it your life. There's far things more important in it than the practice of law. You know, I have a family. I enjoy them. I enjoy being with them. And certainly the practice of law has allowed me to prepare a very nice life for them. But I remember when I, you know, first I was at a new, nothing wrong with New York law firms, but it's a different beast there. I started off practicing at a big New York law firm, patent firm, but they had a D.C. office. And, you know, I would come home 9 o'clock at night and, you know, kissed my kid on the head there when he was a couple of years old, and that was seeing my kid there. And that's why now I make sure that there's a couple days a week that I actually work from home. I go over having lunch with him there. But again, you know, find something outside of law to do that you enjoy doing, and keep making that a part of your life. I remember one of the firms I left. There was I'll just about done there. It was one of the firms I used to work at. And I remember there's an office. You know, most firms allow their retired partners to come in, and he was right next door to me, and he was a retired partner. Wasn't doing any work, but he'd come in. I guess you know, he couldn't leave the office. He had to be there. And I remember he would always be talking to his mother on the phone. And she couldn't hear well, and he couldn't hear well. And his Ma, what'd you say, huh? And I'm like, does he have nothing better to do than to come in here and bug me every day? They hear him hollering at the top of his voice so they can hear you. Why don't you go see her? Instead of calling her every day from the office, go spend some time with her. Do something other than bug me all day long. So again, keep this practice of law in perspective. You've chosen, you've gotten into a great law school. You have a great future ahead of you. Take advantage of this opportunity. This is an investment in yourself. Don't let that investment go bad. You know, you're here for 3 years. Take this 3 years to work the hardest you've ever worked in your life. Because certainly me, my law school grades was the best grades I got since the sandbox when I was in kindergarten. And I say that to say that, you know, make this a priority. This will probably be the last bit of education that you'll do, unless somebody wants to go on and become a doctor one day. But this will probably be it. You know, give it your all, make this your best. And again, 9 o'clock tomorrow, Saturday morning, Eagles, pray for us to win.